Chapter 5 On Centralization and Secession. A state is a territorial monopolist of compulsion, an agency which may engage in continual, institutionalized property rights violations and the exploitation, in the form of expropriation, taxation, and regulation, of private property owners. Assuming no more than self-interest on the part of government agents, all states, governments, can be expected to make use of this monopoly and thus exhibit a tendency towards increased exploitation. On the one hand, this means increased domestic exploitation and internal taxation. On the other hand, and this aspect in particular will be of interest in the following, it means territorial expansionism. States will always try to enlarge their exploitation and tax base. In doing so, however, they will come into conflict with other competing states. The competition between states, qua territorial monopolists of compulsion, is by its very nature an eliminative competition. That is, there can only be one monopolist of exploitation and taxation in any given area. Thus, the competition between different states can be expected to promote a tendency toward increased political centralization and ultimately one single world state. A glance at Western history suffices to illustrate the validity of this conclusion. At the beginning of this millennium, for instance, Europe consisted of thousands of independent political units. Now, only several dozen such units remain. To be sure, decentralizing forces also existed. There was a progressive disintegration of the Ottoman Empire from the 16th century until after World War I and the establishment of modern Turkey. The discontinuous Habsburg Empire was gradually dismembered from the time of its greatest expansion under Charles V until it disappeared and modern Austria was founded in 1918. And only recently, before our very eyes, the former Soviet Empire disintegrated. There are now more than a dozen independent states on the soil of the former Soviet Union. The former Yugoslavia consists now of Slovenia, Croatia, Serbia, Macedonia, and Bosnia. And the Czechs and the Slovaks have split and formed independent countries. However, the overriding tendency was in the opposite direction. For instance, during the second half of the 17th century, Germany consisted of some 234 countries, 51 free cities, and 1,500 independent knightly manors. By the early 19th century, the total number of the three had fallen to below 50, and by 1871, unification had been achieved. The scenario in Italy was similar. Even small states have a history of expansion and centralization. Switzerland began in 1291 as a confederation of three independent cantonal states. By 1848, it was a single, federal state with some two dozen cantonal provinces. Moreover, from a global perspective, mankind has come closer than ever before to the establishment of a world government. Even before the dissolution of the Soviet Empire, the United States had attained hegemonical status over Western Europe, most notably over West Germany, and the Pacific Rim countries, most notably over Japan, as indicated by the presence of American troops and military bases, by the NATO and SEATO pacts, by the role of the American dollar as the ultimate international reserve currency, and of the U.S. Federal Reserve System as the lender or liquidity provider of last resort for the entire Western banking system, and by institutions such as the International Monetary Fund, IMF, the World Bank, and the recently established World Trade Organization, WTO. In addition, under American hegemony, the political integration of Western Europe has steadily advanced. With the recent establishment of a European Central Bank and a European currency, Euro, the European community is near completion. At the same time, with the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, a significant step toward the political integration of the American continent has been taken. In the absence of the Soviet Empire and its military threat, the United States has emerged as the world's sole and undisputed military superpower and its top cop. According to the orthodox view, centralization is generally a good and progressive movement, for its disintegration and secession, even if sometimes unavoidable, represent an anachronism. It is assumed that larger political units, and ultimately a single world government, imply wider markets and hence increased wealth. As evidence of this, it is pointed out that economic prosperity has increased dramatically with increased centralization. However, rather than reflecting any truth, this orthodox view is more illustrative of the fact that history is typically written by its victors. Correlation or temporal coincidence do not prove causation. In fact, the relationship between economic prosperity and centralization is very different from, and indeed almost the opposite, of what orthodoxy alleges. Political integration, centralization, and economic, market integration, are two completely different phenomena. Political integration involves the territorial expansion of a state's power of taxation and property regulation, expropriation. Economic integration is the extension of the interpersonal and interregional division of labor and market participation. In principle, in taxing and regulating private property owners and market income earners, all governments are counterproductive. They reduce market participation and the formation of economic wealth. Once the existence of a government has been assumed, however, no direct relationship between territorial size and economic integration exists. Switzerland and Albania are both small countries, but Switzerland exhibits a high degree of economic integration, whereas Albania does not. Both the US and the former Soviet Union are large, yet while there is much division of labor and market participation in the US, there was almost no economic integration in the Soviet Union, where virtually no private capital ownership existed. Centralization, then, can go hand in hand with either economic progress or retrogression. Progress results whenever a less taxing and regulating government expands its territory at the expense of a more exploitative one. If the reverse occurs, centralization implies economic disintegration and retrogression. However, there is a highly important indirect relationship between size and economic integration. A central government ruling over large-scale territories, and even less so a single world government, cannot come into existence ab ovo. Instead, all institutions with the power to tax and regulate owners of private property must start out small. Smallness contributes to moderation, however. A small government has many close competitors, and if it taxes and regulates its own subjects visibly more than its competitors, it is bound to suffer from the emigration of labor and capital and a corresponding loss of future tax revenue. Consider a single household or a village as an independent territory, for instance. Could a father do to his son or a mayor to his village what the government of the Soviet Union did to its subjects, that is, deny them any right to private capital ownership, or what governments all across Western Europe and the US do to their citizens, that is, expropriate up to 50% of their productive output? Obviously not. There would either be an immediate revolt, and the government would be overthrown, or emigration to another nearby household or village would ensue. Political competition, then, is a far more effective device for limiting a government's natural desire to expand its exploitative powers than are internal constitutional limitations. Indeed, the attempts of some public choice theorists and of constitutional economics to design liberal model constitutions must strike one as hopelessly naive. For constitutional courts and Supreme Court judges are part and parcel of the government apparatus whose powers they are supposed to limit. Why in the world should they want to constrain the power of the very organization that provides them with jobs, money, and prestige? To assume so is not only theoretically inconsistent, that is, incompatible with the assumption of self-interest. The assumption is also without any historical foundation. Despite the explicit limitation of the power of the central government contained in the 10th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, for instance, it has been the interpretation by the U.S. Supreme Court which has rendered the amendment essentially null and void. Similarly, despite the constitutional guarantee of private property by the West German Constitution, for instance, the German Supreme Court, after the German reunification in 1990, declared all communist expropriations prior to the founding of the East German state in 1949 valid. Thus, more than 50% of former East Germany's land used for agriculture were appropriated by the West German state rather than being returned to the original private owners, as required by a literal interpretation of the Constitution. Contrary to orthodoxy, then, precisely the fact that Europe possessed a highly decentralized power structure composed of countless independent political units explains the origin of capitalism, the expansion of market participation, and of economic growth in the Western world. The importance of international anarchy for the rise of European capitalism has been justly emphasized by Jean Bechler. Thus, he writes in The Origins of Capitalism, "The constant expansion of the market, both in extensiveness and in intensity, was the result of an absence of a political order extending over the whole of Western Europe. The expansion of capitalism owes its origin and raison d'être to political anarchy. Collectivism and state management have only succeeded in school textbooks. All power tends toward the absolute. If it is not absolute, this is because some kind of limitations have come into play. Those in the position of power at the center ceaselessly try to erode these limitations. They have never succeeded, and for the reason that also seems to me to be tied to the international system, a limitation of power to act externally and a constant threat of foreign assault. The two characteristics of a multipolar system imply that power is also limited internally and must rely on autonomous centers of decision-making, and so may use them only sparingly." End quote. It is not by accident that capitalism first flourished under conditions of extreme political decentralization. in the northern Italian city-states, in southern Germany, and in the secessionist Low Countries, Netherlands.
The competition among small states for taxable subjects brings them into conflict with each other. As a result of interstate conflicts, historically drawn out over the course of centuries, a few states succeed in expanding their territories while others are eliminated or incorporated. Which states win in this process of eliminative competition depends on many factors, of course, but in the long run, the decisive factor is the relative amount of economic resources at a government's disposal. Through taxation and regulation, governments do not positively contribute to the creation of economic wealth. Instead, they parasitically draw on existing wealth. However, they can influence the amount of existing wealth negatively. Other things being equal, the lower the tax and regulation burden imposed by a government on its domestic economy, the larger its population tends to grow, due to internal reasons as well as immigration factors, and the larger the amount of domestically produced wealth on which it can draw in its conflicts with neighboring competitors. For this reason, centralization is frequently progressive. States which tax and regulate their domestic economies little, liberal states, tend to defeat and expand their territories at the expense of non-liberal ones. This accounts for the outbreak of the Industrial Revolution in centralized England and France. It explains why, in the course of the 19th century, Western Europe came to dominate the rest of the world rather than the other way around, and why this colonialism was generally progressive. Furthermore, it explains the rise of the US to the rank of superpower in the course of the 20th century. However, the further the process of more liberal governments defeating less liberal ones proceeds, that is, the larger the territories, the fewer and more distant the remaining competitors, and thus the more costly international migration, the lower a government's incentive to continue in its domestic liberalism will be. As one approaches the limit of a one-world state, all possibilities of voting with one's feet against a government disappear. Wherever one goes, the same tax and regulation structure applies. Thus relieved of the problem of emigration, a fundamental rein on the expansion of governmental power is gone. This explains developments of the 20th century, with World War I, and even more so with World War II, the US attained hegemony over Western Europe and became heir to its vast colonial empires. A decisive step in the direction of global unification was taken with the establishment of a Pax Americana. And indeed, throughout the entire period, the US, Western Europe, and most of the rest of the world have suffered from a steady and dramatic growth of government power, taxation, and regulatory expropriation. In light of social and economic theory and history, then, a case for secession can be made. Initially, secession is nothing more than a shifting of control over the nationalized wealth from a larger, central government to a smaller, regional one. Whether this leads to more or less economic integration and prosperity depends largely on the new regional government's policies. However, the act of secession in itself has a positive impact on production, for one of the most important reasons for secession is typically the belief on the part of the secessionists that they and their territory are being exploited by others. The Slovenes felt, and rightly so, that they were being robbed systematically by the Serbs and the Serbian-dominated Central Yugoslavian government. The Baltic people resented the fact that they had to pay tribute to the Russians and the Russian-dominated government of the Soviet Union. Similarly, one of the decisive reasons for the attempts by the Southern Confederacy to secede from the American Union was the Morrill Tariff Act of 1861, which imposed a 47% tax on the value of all imported goods. At the time, the American South exported 3/4 of its agricultural output and imported in turn most of its manufactured goods from abroad. In effect, the tariff meant that the South was forced to pay higher taxes that went to the North to subsidize inefficient Northern manufacturers and industrial workers. By virtue of secession, hegemonic domestic relations are replaced by contractual, mutually beneficial foreign relations. Instead of forced integration, there's voluntary separation. Forced integration, as also illustrated by measures such as busing, rent controls, affirmative action, anti-discrimination laws, and, as will be explained shortly, free immigration, invariably creates tension, hatred, and conflict. In contrast, voluntary separation leads to harmony and peace. Under forced integration, any mistake can be blamed on a foreign group or culture, and all success claimed as one's own. Hence, there is little reason for any culture to learn from another. Under a regime of separate but equal, one must face up to the reality not only of cultural diversity, but in particular of visibly different ranks of cultural advancement. If a secessionist people wishes to improve or maintain its position vis-à-vis a competing one, nothing but discriminative learning will help. It must imitate, assimilate, and, if possible, improve upon the skills, traits, practices, and rules characteristic of more advanced societies, and it must avoid those characteristic of less advanced societies. Rather than promoting a downward leveling of cultures as under forced integration, secession stimulates a cooperative process of cultural selection and advancement. Egalitarian propaganda notwithstanding, enormous differences with respect to the degree of cultural advancement exist, for instance in former Yugoslavia between Slovenes, Croats, Serbs and Kosovo Albanians and or Catholics, Orthodox and Muslims, or in the former Soviet Union between Latvians, Estonians, Lithuanians, Germans, Poles, Ukrainians, Russians, Georgians, Romanians, Armenians, Chechens, Azerbaijanis, Turkmenis, Kazakhs, and so on. The immediate result of the political separation of these culturally distinct people will simply be an increased variety of governments and forms of social organization. It will have to be expected further, however, that some of these newly independent governments and their social policies will be worse, from the point of view of economic integration and prosperity, than those that would have prevailed if the former central government had remained in power, while others will turn out to be better. For instance, it may well be worse for Azerbaijanis to be ruled by a native government than by one made up of Russians, or for Kosovo Albanians to fall into the hands of some of their own rather than those of a Serbian government. At the same time, the social policies in Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania, for instance, will likely be better than what a Russian government would have had in store, and Croatians will prosper more under home rule than if they had remained under Serbian control. Secession, then, will not eliminate cultural differences and rank orders, and indeed it may well accentuate them. And yet, precisely in laying bare the cultural differences and different ranks of socio-economic development of various people, secession will in time provide the best stimulus for the cultural and economic advancement of all people, developed and undeveloped alike. Moreover, while everything else depends on the new regional government's domestic policies, and no direct relationship between size and economic integration exists, there is an important indirect connection. Just as political centralization ultimately tends to promote economic disintegration, so secession tends to advance integration and economic development. First, secession always involves the breaking away of a smaller from a larger population and is thus a vote against the principle of democracy and majoritarian rule in favor of private, decentralized ownership. More importantly, secession always involves increased opportunities for inter-regional migration, and a secessionist government is immediately confronted with the threat of emigration. To avoid the loss, in particular, of its most productive subject, it comes under increased pressure to adopt comparatively liberal domestic policies by allowing more private property and imposing a lower tax and regulation burden than its neighbors. An excellent example of the reform pressure caused by emigration is provided by the case of former East Germany. Having fallen under the control of the Soviet Union and turned socialist in the wake of World War II, East Germany suffered from its very inception from a massive outflow of people leaving for the more liberal and hence prosperous interventionist Social Democratic West Germany. By the early 1960s, the number of emigrants had swollen to about 1,000 per day. In reaction, on August 13, 1961, the East German government felt compelled to erect a border system with walls, barbed wire, electrified fences, minefields, automatic shooting devices and watchtowers almost 900 miles long, for the sole purpose of preventing East Germans from running away from socialism. From 1961 until the spring of 1989, the problem could thus be contained. However, when Allied Socialist Hungary then began to relax its border controls vis-à-vis Austria, persuaded, as it now turns out, by members of the Pan-European Union, led by Otto von Habsburg, the wave of East German emigration immediately resumed. In fact, within just a few days, the number of East Germans escaping to the West via Hungary rose to more than 2,000 per day. It was these events, above all else, that led first to the overthrow of the Honecker regime in East Germany, then, on the forever memorable November 9, 1989, to the dismantling of the Berlin Wall, and finally, in the following year, to the reunification of Germany. Ultimately, with as many territories as separate households, villages, or towns, the opportunities for economically motivated emigration is maximized and government power over a domestic economy minimized. Specifically, the smaller the country, the greater will be the pressure to opt for free trade rather than protectionism. All government interference with foreign trade forcibly limits the range of mutually beneficial interterritorial exchanges and thus leads to relative impoverishment at home as well as abroad. But the smaller a territory and its internal market, the more dramatic this effect will be. A country the size of the U.S., for instance, might attain comparatively high standards of living, even if it renounced all foreign trade, provided it possessed an unrestricted internal capital and consumer goods market. In contrast, if predominantly Serbian cities or counties seceded from surrounding Croatia, and if they pursued the same protectionism, this would likely spell disaster. Consider a single household as the conceivably smallest secessionist unit. By engaging in unrestricted free trade, even the smallest territory can be fully integrated into the world market and partake of every advantage of the division of labor, and its owners may become the wealthiest people on earth. The existence of a single wealthy individual anywhere is living proof of this. On the other hand, if the same household owners decided to forego all interterritorial trade, abject poverty or death would result. Accordingly, the smaller a territory and its internal market, the more likely it is that it will opt for free trade. Moreover, secession also promotes monetary integration. The process of centralization has also resulted in monetary disintegration, the destruction of the former international commodity, gold money standard, and its replacement with a dollar-dominated system of freely fluctuating government paper monies, that is, a global, U.S.-led government counterfeiting cartel. However, a system of freely fluctuating paper currencies, the Friedmanite monetarist ideal, is strictly speaking no monetary system at all. It is a system of partial barter, dysfunctional of the very purpose of money, of facilitating rather than complicating exchange. This becomes obvious once it is recognized that from the point of view of economic theory, there is no special significance attached to the way national borders are drawn. Yet, if one then imagines a proliferation of ever smaller national territories, ultimately to the point where each household forms its own country, Friedman's proposal is revealed for what it is, an outright absurdity. For if every household were to issue its own paper currency, the world would be right back at barter. No one would accept anyone else's paper, economic calculation would be impossible, and trade would come to a virtual standstill. See on this in particular Rothbard, the case for a 100% gold dollar. One problem, explains Rothbard, that every monetary statist and nationalist has failed to face is the geographical boundary of each money. If there should be national fluctuating fiat money, what should be the boundaries of the nation? Surely political frontiers have little or no economic meaning. Logically, the ultimate in freely fluctuating fiat monies is a different money issued by each and every individual. I think it would be instructive if some economist devoted himself to an intensive analysis of what such a world would look like. I think it's safe to say that the world would be back to an enormously complex and chaotic form of barter, for there would no longer be any sort of monetary medium for exchanges. Each separate exchange would require a different money. In fact, since money means a general medium of exchanges, it is doubtful if the very concept of money would any longer apply. In short, fluctuating fiat monies are disintegrative of the very function of money itself. They contradict the essence of the monetary function. Hence, Rothbard concludes, the more general the money, the greater the scope for division of labor and for the interregional exchange of goods and services that stem from the market economy. A monetary medium is therefore critical to the free market, and the wider the use of this money, the more extensive the market and the better it can function. In short, true freedom of trade does require an international commodity money, gold and silver. Any breakup of such an international medium by statist fiat paper inevitably cripples and disintegrates the free market and robs the world of the fruits of that market. End quote. It is only due to centuries of political centralization and the fact that only a relatively small number of countries and national currencies remain, and hence that the disintegrative consequences and calculational difficulties are far less severe, that this could have been overlooked. From this theoretical insight, it follows that secession, provided it proceeds far enough, will actually promote monetary integration. In a world of hundreds of thousands of independent political units, each country would have to abandon the current fiat money system, which has been responsible for the greatest worldwide inflation in all of human history, and once again adopt an international commodity money system, such as the gold standard. Secessionism and the growth of separatist and regionalist movements throughout the world represent not an anachronism, but potentially the most progressive historical forces, especially in light of the fact that with the fall of the Soviet Union, we have moved closer than ever to the establishment of a new world order. Secession increases ethnic, linguistic, religious, and cultural diversity, while centuries of centralization have stamped out hundreds of distinct cultures. Secession will end the forced integration brought about by centralization and rather than stimulating social strife and cultural leveling, it will promote the peaceful, cooperative competition of different, territorially separate cultures. In particular, it eliminates the immigration problem increasingly plaguing the countries of Western Europe as well as the US. Presently, whenever the central government permits immigration, it allows foreigners to proceed, literally on government-owned roads, to any of its residents' doorsteps, regardless of whether or not these residents desire such proximity to foreigners. Thus, to a large extent, free immigration is forced integration. Secession solves this problem by letting smaller territories each have their own admission standards and determine independently with whom they will associate on their own territory and with whom they prefer to cooperate from a distance. Lastly, secession promotes economic integration and development. The process of centralization has resulted in the formation of an international, U.S.-dominated government cartel of managed migration, trade, and fiat money, ever more invasive and burdensome governments, globalized welfare, warfare, statism, and economic stagnation, or even declining standards of living. Secession, if it is extensive enough, could change all this. The world would consist of tens of thousands of distinct countries, regions, and cantons, and of hundreds of thousands of independent free cities, such as the present-day oddities of Monaco, Andorra, San Marino, Liechtenstein, Hong Kong, and Singapore. Greatly increased opportunities for economically motivated migration would result, and the world would be one of small liberal governments economically integrated through free trade and an international commodity money such as gold. It would be a world of unheard prosperity, economic growth, and cultural advancement. With respect to the cultural advancement which can be expected from this development, it is appropriate to conclude with some pertinent observations by the greatest German writer and poet Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, 1749-1832. On October 23, 1828, when Germany was still splintered into 39 independent states, Goethe explained in a conversation with Johann Peter Eckermann, Gespräche mit Goethe in den letzten Jahren seines Lebens, on the desirability of German political unity, that I do not fear that Germany will not be united. She is united because the German Thaler and Groschen have the same value throughout the entire empire, and because my suitcase can pass through all 36 states without being opened. Germany is united in the areas of weights and measures, trade and migration, and 100 similar things. One is mistaken, however, if one thinks that Germany's unity should be expressed in the form of one large capital city, and that this great city might benefit the masses in the same way that it might benefit the development of a few outstanding individuals. A thoughtful Frenchman, I believe Daupin, has drawn up a map regarding the state of culture in France, indicating the higher or lower level of enlightenment of its various départements by lighter or darker colors. There we find, especially in the southern provinces far away from the capital, some départements painted entirely in black, indicating a complete cultural darkness. Would this be the case if the beautiful France had 10 centers instead of just one, from which light and life radiated? What makes Germany great is her admirable popular culture, which has penetrated all parts of the empire evenly. And is it not the many different princely residences from whence this culture springs, and which are its bearers and curators? Just assume that for centuries only the two capitals of Vienna and Berlin had existed in Germany, or even only a single one. Then, I'm wondering, what would have happened to the German culture and the widespread prosperity that goes hand in hand with culture? Germany has 20 universities strewn out across the entire empire, more than 100 public libraries, and a similar number of art collections and natural museums. For every prince wanted to attract such beauty and good. Gymnasia and technical and industrial schools exist in abundance. Indeed, there's hardly a German village without its own school. How is this in regard in France? Furthermore, look at the number of German theatres, which exceeds 70. The appreciation of music and song and the performance is nowhere as prevalent as in Germany. Then think about cities such as Dresden, Munich, Stuttgart, Kassel, Braunschweig, Hanover, and similar ones. Think about the energy that these cities represent. Think about the effects they have on neighboring provinces, and ask yourself if all of this would exist if such cities had not been the residences of princes for a long time. Frankfurt, Bremen, Hamburg, Lübeck are large and brilliant, and their impact on the prosperity of Germany is incalculable. Yet would they remain what they are if they were to lose their independence and be incorporated as provincial cities into one great German empire? I have reason to doubt this.